Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
In which the theme of the program is negotiating. On Capitol Hill, yes, over big, consequential money things. Also, between you and your kids, over maybe less consequential money things. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, I do believe the 28th day of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a trio of stories on the economic issue of the day, other than the virus, of course, which is an economic story as well, lest we forget. But we speak here and now of the rescue package that Congress is about to start really digging into. Democrats in the House and Republicans in the Senate getting down to it. Up first in our stories, playing off a quote from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on CNBC this afternoon that he is not going to negotiate with Democrats. That's the quote. I am not negotiating over this. Over corporate coronavirus liability protections in this bill. They're going to be in there, McConnell says, or there won't be a bill. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going with a look at the fault lines on this issue.
As businesses reopen in a pandemic, they're faced with this reality. Even if they require masks and social distancing and provide hand sanitizer.
It still may not stop somebody from contracting coronavirus from somebody else that may be at their place of business.
That could mean an expensive lawsuit and even the demise of a business. So the GOP relief package would make it a lot harder for customers or workers to win a COVID-related lawsuit against a business. There are some exceptions in the bill.
If you're grossly negligent or you intentionally engage in harmful behavior, if you are acting that way, you're not going to be protected, and you shouldn't be.
The thing is, gross negligence, that's one of the terms from the bill, is a really high legal bar. David Super teaches law at Georgetown University.
It doesn't just mean you were sloppy or careless. Grossly negligent is sort of the equivalent of drunk driving in the wrong direction on an interstate.
Lawyers for workers or customers would also have to prove that a business was not making reasonable efforts to comply with local COVID safety rules. Deborah Marcuse, an employment attorney who represents workers at Sanford Heisler Sharp, says all of this would send a message to companies.
That taking risks with the lives of workers and customers won't harm their bottom line. That's an incredibly dangerous message to send during a pandemic.
Now, even though there's been a lot of debate about this so far, there haven't been that many COVID-related personal injury lawsuits against businesses. A very small percentage of coronavirus lawsuits fall into that category, according to the law firm Hunt & Andrews Kurth. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Another key sticking point in whatever this bill is going to wind up looking like, expanded unemployment benefits. We have covered that a lot, so the broad outlines you know. Senate Republicans want to cut those benefits from $600 a week to $200 a week until state unemployment systems can be reprogrammed to make the payments equal 70% of a now laid off worker's previous income. That's complicated, but it's incredibly relevant. It's also going to take a while, 8 to 20 weeks, reports are. But with that, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has this on the political costs and benefits of those unemployment checks.
Denise Kochak runs Turquoise Restaurant in Midtown West in Manhattan. As restaurants reopened there last month, she started calling her staff back to work, and some said no. They told her unemployment was paying them more than what she would.
On an average, they're getting $800, $900 a week. Some of them didn't even used to make this much per week.
She said it complicated her reopening.
You know, we did get some PPP from the government, but that becoming turned into a grant is reliant on part of it being used as payroll. And of course, it's very hard to get, you know, the people back.
As the expiration date for benefits got closer, Kochak says, workers eventually came back. Now, there is a debate over how common Kochak's situation is. Joseph Vavra is a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
lots of workers in the economy are currently eligible for unemployment benefits, which exceed their lost wages.
But he says it's not clear how often that causes someone to not take a job. People value certainty, he says, and some workers may go back to work for healthcare, for example. He also says if an employer reports that it has reoffered a job to a laid-off employee and that employee declined to come back because they make more in unemployment, that worker is no longer eligible for benefits.
To me, it seems less likely that a worker is going to refuse to go back to work in this very uncertain labor market right now.
Heidi Scherholz is with the Economic Policy Institute. She says some amount of expanded unemployment benefits is a good idea beyond their current expiration date.
Government spending on unemployment insurance benefits is one of the most, if not the most, effective thing the federal government can do for stimulating the economy.
Mark Goldwein, with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, says unemployment benefits can't stay so high indefinitely without potentially slowing a recovery, but now is not the time to make drastic cuts.
Probably the smart thing to do is to unwind it slowly.
How slowly? Well, that is what is being negotiated right now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Among the more hidden realities of this pandemic and what it's doing to people in this economy is the sharp increase in the number of people who need food assistance. The Agriculture Department is going to start the third round of its food box distribution program in September. The idea is to package up food from farmers that might otherwise have gone to waste, think meat and produce and dairy, and get it to needy families. Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into how that's been going so far.
The Idaho Food Bank started distributing food boxes through the program about 2 months ago. Chief Development Officer Morgan Wilson says its mobile trucks, its partners, and its drive-thru centers have distributed boxes to nearly 30,000 families so far.
They're asked very simple questions around how many people are in their household, and then that food is loaded directly into either their car or their trunk with very minimal contact.
Wilson says it does require a lot of coordination. The food bank works with vendors who package those boxes. Those vendors work with farmers who have lost a market for many of their crops. Jared Slindy at the Great Plains Food Bank in North Dakota says his program is bringing in about 1 million pounds of produce each month.
It's coming from U.S. farmers. It's getting trucked up to us from states away.
Food boxes can be helpful in the short run, says Craig Gunderson, a professor of ag economics at the University of Illinois. But long term, he says food boxes can't help people at the scale of the government's food benefits program, SNAP.
If you were to put together these food boxes to supply the same amount of food that's been given through SNAP, it would just be just enormous.
Gunderson says the average benefit under SNAP is about $275 a month. The maximum can be much more. And packing up all that food in a box would be expensive.
And almost prohibitively expensive, if we were to include, dairy in that, if we were to include meat in that.
He says SNAP benefits also help people choose what food to buy themselves, rather than having to rely on what's in the box. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Couple indicators as we slide into the rest of the program. Crude oil lost 1.5% today, right around $40 a barrel. Gold, Scott Tong was talking about this yesterday. Up to $1,944 an ounce. Remember, as Scott said, rising gold usually means falling confidence. Such was the case in stocks as well on this Tuesday. Not a very confident session on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are now government mask requirements of one sort or another in more than 30 states. Companies, too, have mask policies. And yet there is resistance to what public health experts say are the keys to fighting this virus: masks, social distancing, and staying home when possible. It is kind of a head-scratcher, honestly, but behavioral economists, not so surprised, because it turns out that a lot of times people make decisions that are, in the words of one Nobel Prize-winning economist, predictably irrational. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that.
Study after study suggests that humans are good followers. We tend to make decisions about whether to wear a helmet or give blood, how much alcohol to drink, that are eerily similar to those who live by us, who think like us. perhaps even shop like us. In Upper Michigan, grad student Audrey Bauman says in the pandemic, she's seen mask wearing vary hugely at her two local supermarkets, Walmart versus Meijer.
Meijer, I would say like masking about 60-70%. Walmart, I would say like 10 to 20. It was a big difference.
The stores are right by each other.
Same town, same highway. Town of like 10,000 or something.
We should note that Walmart has just required masks at all its stores. Conscious or not, many of us choose whether to mask based on our team, based on our identity. Researchers at Syracuse University found that the biggest predictor for masks is not age, it's not location, it's party. And a new Gallup poll seems to confirm that. More than 90% of Democrats always or very often wear masks, compared to 40-some for Republicans. Psychologist Gretchen Chapman teaches decision science at Carnegie Mellon.
Our behavior is guided by so many more factors than just the facts that we know. You know, what are other people like us doing? What does my behavior say about the groups that I belong with?
But why? Why do studies find we use less electricity when we're told that our neighbor cuts back? Behavioral economist Cian Bonneau at Swarthmore says this tendency to follow is a powerful rule of thumb. It's a mental shortcut we use.
We really lean on the behavior of others around us, because if you think about every single decision as one you have to rationally think through the costs and benefits, you would never get anything done in a day.
He calls this a social norm. And as the pandemic gets worse, the norm of mask wearing is in general trending up. But polls suggest social distancing, not so much. Gene Hyde, who owns a printing shop in Little Rock, Arkansas, complains about her supermarket.
People weren't following the little arrows to go one way down the aisles and just cutting in front of you to grab what they wanted. It was like the mask was the superhero and you don't have to social distance if you got one of those on.
When people go against expert advice, can you persuade them to change? Maybe. Consider this ad campaign from the 80s.
Mamas, tell all your babies, don't mess with Texas.
That familiar phrase, don't mess with Texas, actually came from this state marketing campaign to end littering.
Don't let them throw cans from them old pickup trucks. Don't let them throw bottles and papers and such.
Seems Texans listened to old Willie Nelson. Organizers said in 4 years, littering fell 71%. And today, Montana is trying a similar message, with posters and digital ads featuring masked men doing outdoorsy things, like fishing and riding snowmobiles. The caption, Montanans wear face coverings all the time. Again, Cian Bonneau.
You know, you cover your face when you're out hunting, you cover your face when you're out skiing. This isn't that different than that. It's trying to destigmatize mask wearing.
Thing is, these public health actions can be hard to sustain. They require sacrifice.
Mask wearing, social distancing, you stay at home, you know, you don't get to do the fun things with your friends. So you're bearing a personal cost.
And you don't get an immediate reward. So in the math of behavioral economics, the cost outweighs the benefit. Again, decision scientist Gretchen Chapman.
It's also hard to get people to recycle and conserve energy, get vaccinated. We are only partially successful at all of those behaviors. There's no reason to think that mask wearing would be special.
She says the good news is people do stick with something if there's an instant reward. We brush our teeth because of the minty feeling after. And just so you know, there are scented masks out there, peppermint and bubblegum flavor. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There's been a big jump, Yelp says, in searches on that platform for Black-owned businesses. For Maggie Anderson, though, she's the founder of the Empowerment Experiment. Buying from Black-owned businesses is more than just a trend. We had Maggie and her husband John on the program back in 2012 when her book came out. It's called Our Black Year. So 8 years later, we got her back on the phone.
I'm Maggie Anderson. I am the creator of the Empowerment Experiment and the author of Our Black Year, my family's year-long stand, completely living off of Black-owned businesses. When we decided to take on this public pledge, we had no idea how hard it would be. There was only one Black-owned grocery store in all of Illinois, and that grocery store closed 5 months before we finished our year. And I have two little girls. That means no fresh milk, no fresh meats, no fresh produce. But I put them through that because we took the stand and we wanted really to do something extreme out of love for our community, to expose how few Black businesses there still are, to refute negative stereotypes about Black-owned businesses, and to expose economic injustice that still persists in America. After the year, I decided that I could not go back to corporate. I could not go back to law. I've made this issue of economic racism and really trying to create economic empowerment in our Black community my life. The Black hair care firms, they sustained the civil rights movement. Black women created these companies, huge, thriving companies, and we needed that. We talk about Black Wall Street now because we shine a light on what happened in Tulsa. Most Black neighborhoods were anchored by these Black Wall Streets. And if we could bring that back, America would be better. I'm not saying bring all of it back. That would probably be impossible. But we can bring Black hair care back. There are great Black hair care companies that exist, Black-owned hair care companies that exist right now. And it would be wonderful for, in America, just like other groups own their culturally relevant products and industries, that the Black community can own the biggest Black hair care brands, that the Black community can own Black beauty supply stores. 3% of the beauty supply stores in Black neighborhoods. And Black people know what I'm talking about. If you go into a Black neighborhood, you're going to see a beauty supply store, and they're going to sell all the Black hair care products that only Black people use, and they are not owned by Black people. So I've issued the Black-owned hair care challenge, just asking everyday folks to say, "Hi, my name is Maggie Anderson, and I accept the Black-owned hair care challenge," and tell the world that from now on, if I'm going to buy Black hair care products, I'm going to make sure it's from a Black-owned company.
That was Maggie Anderson in Oak Park, Illinois. We've got a link, by the way, to the Black-owned hair care challenge at marketplace.org. While you're there, take a second, if you've got it, and tell us about your personal economy, would you? Coming up.
Maybe it's too pricey, or maybe it's just too expensive or something. Wait, are they both the same thing?
A revelation on parent speak and negotiations. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 205 points today, 0.7%, 26,379. The NASDAQ down 134 points. That is 1.2%, 10,402. The S&P 500 shrank 20 points, about 0.6%, 32.18. $765 million, that's how much the federal government is going to lend Eastman Kodak. Yes, used to be a photography company, still exists in a different form. The loan under the Defense Production Act is going to help Kodak pivot to manufacturing pharmaceutical ingredients. News of the loan tripled the value of shares in Kodak. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You've got a couple of months yet to say goodbye to O, the Oprah magazine. Hearst has announced that this year's December issue is going to be its last regular print edition. O is just the latest in a long line of glossies that have either stopped publishing altogether, a la Redbook and Glamour, or paused publication, which is what W did a couple of months ago. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports now on the pandemic economics of women's magazines.
The glossies were already struggling. Then came the COVID-19 pandemic.
This could be a final straw that some of them might go under.
That's CFRA analyst Camilla Yanishevsky. Many of the retailers that were still buying advertising space in women's magazines are shifting to digital because that's where people are spending their time and their money. Tamai Sadari, who teaches luxury marketing at NYU, says the magazines have to change, just like the industry they depend on.
In the past, magazines were functioning in essence the way a fashion brand functions.
Now, with fewer fashion shows and more digital launches and reliance on social media personalities, a magazine that's put to bed months in advance doesn't make as much sense. The way people buy magazines has changed, too. Lisa Pico-Hebert, a journalism professor at USC Annenberg, says women's titles depended on people picking up issues here and there, like before boarding a plane.
Well, we're not flying, so people aren't in the airport buying magazines. We certainly aren't going to newsstands and just hanging out and looking at magazines to choose because of COVID-19. We aren't even in spaces where we're buying those magazines.
And we're not hanging out in doctors' waiting rooms and salons where we might flip through a copy that's just sitting there. The culture has changed too, says Harriet Brown, a professor of magazine news and digital journalism at Syracuse University. Women's magazines presented a narrow ideal of beauty.
And so that's a problem, and I'm not sure that audiences are really looking for that anymore.
Brown says she will miss some of the work these magazines have done, such as their pioneering work on women's health. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Millions of Americans are struggling to pay their rent or their mortgages. We've talked about that. And while correlation is not causation, a record number of people, especially younger adults, are moving back in with their parents. That's pretty common in a lot of cultures, but in the United States, there's always been something of a stigma, right, around living with your family once you're an adult. But given this virus and the associated economy, that might be changing. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
2 months ago, Eden Kayan made a difficult decision. She and her husband and their one-year-old son moved in with her mom in upstate New York. For Kayan, who's 39, the decision came after what felt like an endless lockdown in a very small Brooklyn apartment.
I couldn't imagine spending the summer in the city with my son.
And she and her husband couldn't afford a bigger place in the city. Eden's story is increasingly common in America. Jeff Tucker is an economist with Zillow. He authored a report which found during this economic crisis,
the number of adults living with their parents jumped by about 10% this spring, starting in April. That's almost 3 million people.
The trend of adults living with parents and grandparents is growing because of the pandemic, but it isn't new. Between 2000 and 2017, the number of 25 to 34-year-olds living with their parents doubled. There is still a stigma about living with parents after a certain age. Back in upstate New York, Eden Kayan says,
it's kind of got the stigma of, like, failure in a way, you know, because you have to go back under their roof and I guess that's how I see it.
Professor Amy Shallett is with the University of Massachusetts.
It's a pretty strong belief in the U.S. that to become an adult, you have to stand on your own 2 feet. You know, the idea of, you know, the rugged individual.
She says as our economy changes, so will the meaning of growing up. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Got a new thing we're doing here at Marketplace, a podcast for kids and their parents, helping make money make more sense. It's called Million Bazillion. And this week, an episode that honestly could maybe be really helpful to some people in Washington, D.C. right now. It's all about negotiation. And here's a tip. Put yourself in the other person's shoes and think about why they might say no, which it turns out kids are pretty good at doing.
I already have a lot of stuff.
Because I'm not allowed to have gum. Because I have braces.
Because I had a bad day.
They give us a lot of stuff that's really important and costs a lot more money than just a toy or like something really fancy.
Maybe it's too pricey or maybe just too expensive or something. Wait, are they both the same thing?
Mom, they know all the time.
Yes, they do. That was Ezra, Sophia, Olivia, Augustine, and Aiden from our new podcast, Million Bazillion. It's for kids and their families. That new episode about negotiating, by the way, is out now wherever you choose to get your downloads. This final note on the way out today, in which the U.S. Mint is asking for your help. We talked about the coin shortage on the program the other day. Well, it's not so much a shortage, really, because there are plenty of actual coins out there. We're just not spending them because pandemic. Anyway, here is the statement from the Mint last week. We ask that the American public start spending their coins, depositing them or exchanging them for currency at financial institutions or taking them to a coin redemption kiosk. So that's me too. Mea culpa. I'm going to get out of the office, get my jars full, get them off my dresser. But two things. Number one, most banks are going to make you roll them before they take them. Also, those redemption kiosks, I think you have to give them like 8 or 9% or something. All right, we are out of here, but not, of course, without your moment of economic context for this Tuesday, Central Bank Edition. The Federal Reserve meets tomorrow. Actually, they're meeting today and tomorrow. The statement and the press conference come out tomorrow. Anyway, interest rates aren't going anywhere. We know that. But we are going to amend our favorite parlor game, What is Jay Powell Thinking, in 5 words or less. This time, what is the over-under on how many times in his press conference and in his statement? So this would be total for the whole, like, hour he's out there. How many times is Jay Powell going to use the phrase fiscal policy or fiscal policymakers? I personally am going with 8. Here we go. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.